following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Okay, welcome back to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. We're glad you could join in with us today. And before we get started, I just want to remind you that just because we discuss certain topics that may be of interest and you think you understand a certain strategy, or maybe are interested in, if you hadn't already started investing in real estate private partnerships, maybe in our discussion today, we may mention certain features or types of projects that are out there right now. And please check with your existing advisors first before you dive in. And let's make sure that you understood correctly what you thought, what you heard meant. And let's see, for those of you that don't have advisors currently that understand or are willing to consult with you on real estate taxation, where it intersects with retirement plan investing, where you're using your 401 or IRA to invest in private partnerships involving real estate, or maybe you're striving to get to the zero tax rate by the time you get to retirement. And I know some of you are thinking, well, yeah, that'd be nice, but surely there's no way I can do that. And I'll just tell you, there is a way. It's not by working for a W-2 or even having a significant amount of self-employment income, but the more real estate income that we can generate, and I say income, I mean cash flow, there's a difference, is there not, between taxable income and cash flow. And that's one of the things that we like about real estate. It tends to generate cash flow well in advance of any taxable gains or rental income. And so we have the ability to defer and defer and defer those gains by either investing in another project. We try to time it in the same year so that we get the benefit of those write-offs. And it does appear that the bonus depreciation that we've enjoyed a lot over the last 5, 6, 7 years is going to be renewed, although there is some static right now. I just read an article earlier today about the Senate is not on board. This would be the GOP in the Senate. The Republicans are not on board with some of the tax cuts and the spending that's been proposed by the House. The Republicans in the House have come up with Mr. Trump's one big beautiful bill, and the House voted Wednesday of this week to advance some of the most contentious parts of the major budget package aimed at addressing the president's agenda. But the Senate's already warned them, you know, don't bring that here because you're not going to be able to pass it in the current form. And, you know, the biggest division is on some of the most major components, including Medicaid and, like I mentioned, certain tax cuts. The SALT tax, you know, the state and local tax deduction is one of the big issues. And, of course, the Medicaid is so material. The Medicare and Medicaid combined are our largest budget component in the annual spending that we do as a nation. I mean, it exceeds the Social Security expenditure. It exceeds interest expense. Interest expense is now the third largest item after Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and over $1 trillion now, which is just insane. And then defense is the fourth. Interest expense actually passed defense this past year. And I don't know, it would seem kind of commonsensical that that's got to pose some type of security risk to us as a nation if we're spending more on paying our interest on borrowed money. And in some cases, it's to some of our largest enemies, China being one. China holds quite a bit of our debt, and as a result, they're a big recipient of the interest payments that we make. But in any event, so for those of you that don't have advisors, I'm going to meander back to where I was a few minutes ago. You can go to our website at baplanner.com, and top right, you'll see, second link from the right, you'll see forms. And if you'll go to the first form on that page that you click there to get to the forms page, step one, form one's a client profile. If you would be kind enough to complete that, then I'll have enough information where we could then have a phone call, which you can schedule by clicking the rightmost link. I think it just says calls. Not on our site right now, but in any event, I'll be happy to spend some time with you on understanding your current facts and circumstances, and then we can help you understand how we might proceed with working with you to help you achieve those goals and objectives. And of course, getting to retirement with enough money is what most people call me about. And unfortunately, or fortunately, as the case may be, most 50 to 60 year olds that are barreling down the tracks to retirement realize they don't have enough money to live through retirement, meaning that their money is going to run out before their living does. And that's going to be a bad outcome. And real estate, especially multifamily real estate, is one of the few types of assets that's capable of getting you caught up to be in a better position for retirement. And if you don't understand that, we can help you by looking at your current numbers and along with what you think it's going to take to make it through retirement. Anyway, if you'll fill those forms out, or at least the first one, and schedule a call, I'll be happy to chat with you for a bit. I want to talk about, we're going to take a break here in a minute before I really get started, but I want to talk about a few concepts involving the operational characteristics of the real estate private partnership syndications. And, you know, it's having been a member of more than a couple of those platforms over the years, I can tell you that there's a lot of, most people, in fact, I won't say a lot, I'll say most new members don't understand how partnerships work. And even, I guess I could say most members of those platforms truly don't, including the lead partners, which is really a shame because they're the ones that of all the people involved need to understand how they function. And yet I don't see many, and I've worked with a lot of lead partners over the 20 plus years I've been consulting in this area. And it's scary to think how little knowledge when it comes to operationally what how an LLC works, which that's how most of these assets are held. And the topic I'm going to talk about is something that will cost you a lot of money if you don't understand and avoid the type of structure that we'll go through here in a moment and discuss. So let's go ahead and take our first break, and we'll circle back momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
If you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-782-1900. That's 713-782-1900. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com. That's Nathan at npross.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Okay, welcome back to more of this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And as I mentioned just before the break, I do want to spend some more time on talking about how partnerships work from a tax and accounting standpoint, only because it's one of the few pieces of evidence that you're going to have that you own a partnership interest, which is that annual K-1 form that you receive from the lead partner, which shows your share of the income, expenses, and perhaps certain other items that are on a K-1. Could be some excess business interest expense, could be some qualified business income. There's several categories that the IRS is now mandating be tracked. It's no longer just a simple exercise of figuring out, oh, here's what came in and here's what went out, and oh yeah, we get to take some depreciation. And the IRS has greatly complicated, and I say the IRS, Congress is the one that mandates it, but IRS is the one that executes those mandates, and it doesn't seem like they much care about the complexity of the manner in which they go about that. But in any event, I guess the way to explain the K-1, the K-1 has assorted lines on it, rows, I guess we would call them, that show you income and expenses. However, one of the most important areas is not in the current year income and expense rows, but it's over on the left side as you look at page one and come down to the reconciliation of partners' capital. And that area is the one that you really need to clue into and understand what's going on there, because it is, if the whole area of partnership accounting, including the tax accounting, was not already complicated enough, it gets more complicated when you're trying to understand how the capital account works and what does the capital account reflect. And yet it's critical, because the capital account is pretty much the gold standard for how we should be making assorted allocations under the regulations that were issued years ago and updated and added to, et cetera, over the years. And the ability for us to allocate things in a disproportionate fashion is one of the best attributes of the whole real estate area of the code. And when I say allocate things disproportionately, it gives us the ability to allocate interest and depreciation, for just to mention a couple items, differently than simply based on the pro rata capital that someone might have. And I don't say that necessarily with respect to the passive investor as much as I do the active investors in a partnership. So the lead partner and or some of the debt guarantors would be who I'm referring to. But in any event, every debit and credit that is recorded on the partnership set of books works its way through the capital accounts of the partner group, and on a net basis. And it's when we talk about whether we're getting distributions, as an example, as we discussed on last week's show, the concept of distributions being treated as a return on our capital versus a return of our capital. And I'm sure if we have some accountants listening in, they're saying, well, wait a minute, Nathan, you know as well as we do that the capital account gets debited for every dollar of distribution that is passed out to a partner. So that partner's on the partner's K-1, on the left side, reconciliation of partner's capital account. It's going to start off with the balance at the beginning of the year, assuming there was a balance. If it's the first year, there won't be a number there. And then you've got contributions, and I'm not looking at a K-1, so forgive me if I don't have the rows in the right order, but trust me, these rows are there that I'm going to reference. So if this is the first year of the partnership, there will be a row, I think it's the second row in that analysis or that reconciliation of capital, will be the contributions for the year, and then there's a row for distributions. I believe it's actually down a few rows.
And in between, we've got the current year net income and loss lines collectively. And what am I leaving off? I don't remember exactly. But the two lines that matter, other than the beginning and ending balance, are what's been added, or three lines, all three, contributions, distributions, net income or loss, because that moves your capital account balance up or down, depending on whether you're putting more money in, whether you're taking money out, whether you had net positive income for the year or negative losses. And the reason you care is because that capital account will dictate, the capital account balance, excuse me, will dictate whether you pay, as an example, you might end up paying capital gains on some of your distributions. And I don't know that I've ever heard a mentor in any of the workshops I've seen or sat in or was a member of, I don't think I've ever once heard them discuss the prospect that you might get taxed on your distributions. That comes as a real shock to clients when we give them their tax returns back. And it's not often. I don't want to make it sound like it's every distribution. But bottom line is, if you're in a really outstanding partnership that's knocking it out of the park from a cash flow standpoint, not necessarily a taxable income standpoint, you might get distributions that combined with the write-offs that you've also been allocated, you could have a negative ending capital account balance. And if you do, and if you have distributions in that year or maybe the next year without having additional income or contributions, which would raise your capital account back up, you could possibly be paying capital gains on distributions. And so when we talk about return on versus return of, the critical distinction that I made last week was, if you have an operating agreement that has certain waterfall provisions, which are the provisions that dictate how money gets passed out to the partner group, and if there's a certain level of money that you've received that essentially is representing the return of your capital, then typically in most operating agreements there's some bonus money that will kick in that goes to the lead partner. And maybe I shouldn't say of most agreements, I'll say of many agreements. And the reason that I find that to be a bit distasteful is because the deck is pretty much already tilted to the lead partner, or the team, I guess we might say, in terms of them getting money that's not proportionate to the money that they actually have invested. And you have to remember, they've got a promote, which is another word for an override already. They're already collecting assorted fees pretty much from day one, not necessarily in accordance with whether you've gotten any of your money back. Again, something I find distasteful. I feel like, hey, if we're going to dine, we should dine together off the fruits of the partnership. And there's nothing wrong with fees, in my mind, provided they're paid after you and I, as passive partners, have gotten our money back. Otherwise, you know, we should be participating in those same distributions, would be my thoughts on that topic. But in any event, the issue that I raised last week is a critical distinction in terms of what the distribution was received for. And in many cases, and I'll promise you, if you try to pin the lead partner down on why are you doing that particular process, they won't know. They won't even know what you're talking about, because some syndication attorney has drafted the agreement. He did what he did on the last 13 that he drafted and didn't think about that one change, which would change other, you know, significant pages or paragraphs, at least, in the operating agreement that they're drafting. But you and the other passive partners will care, especially if at the point they've given you your capital back, quote unquote, now the lead partner gets to raise their allocation of cash flow up from maybe 20% to 30% or 50%, as the case may be. Now you begin to understand why it's critical that those distributions not be counted as a return of your capital, but rather should be considered as return on your capital. Think about another example. Let's say we buy Apple stock at some point, and I don't know if Apple pays a dividend or not, but let's just assume it does. I'm not in stock market, but let's assume Apple declares a dividend and pays out a $10 dividend, and you own 1,000 shares. So now you've got a $10,000 distribution. Do you think that that gets treated as a reduction in your cost basis for purposes of the dividend that you've received? And now your stock, your interest is less by $1,000 or $10,000 than what you thought you had? No, no way. Well, why do we allow that with lead partners effectively doing that with our partnership ownership in a syndication transaction? And I know I'm simplifying it, and I know lead partners are howling at this point about, well, he doesn't understand our deal. Well, you know what? I don't really need to understand your deal as much as I understand the structure and how those formations end up tilting the deck, the lead partner direction, even more. And by the way, that doesn't change any amount of money that will be clawed back, because there are no clawbacks. Every deal you're in, the lead partner keeps all the fees they got and whatever distributions they've gotten, whether you got any or not, if the deal goes south, as many have and are in the process of going south right now with the debt structures that have not done well given the increase in interest rates. And typically the ones that are the most suspect are the three-year bridge debt types that started showing up almost exclusively. When I say exclusively, almost most lenders were mandating the three-year bridge debt back 22, 23, etc. So now they're all looking for a home to refinance, or properties are going back, and we haven't seen the worst of it yet. Should get there later this year, according to most forecasters. But anyway, the capital account is a concept that you really must make an effort to learn if you're going to invest in, well, if you're going to invest in any partnership. This isn't relative to real estate, but, you know, just to close the loop on the discussion about return on or return of, I want to be clear that in the tax accounting sense, any distribution reduces your ending capital account balance as of the end of this year. But the language in the operating agreement that discusses the waterfalls on how we calculate distributions that get paid at or paid out, those don't have to agree with tax logic. And in most cases, they don't. I mean, they will be taxed according to tax logic, don't get me wrong, but in terms of calculating allocations, those distributions needn't pose a problem by the concept that, hey, you're going to get a distribution based on what you originally put in. In most cases, the way that I draft these documents, and I would tell you that's what most partners think they're signing up for. They don't think they're signing up for reduced distributions because they've managed to join a successful partnership that's had cash flows that were available for distribution out to the partners. So anyway, I know it's complicated, and I'll continue to opine on this area. I'll try to perhaps get some examples. Maybe we can post them on our site and give you a better idea of how to analyze your K-1 and track it each year and understand, you know, realistically, what do I have left in terms of sharing capability on future cash flows. Let's do this. Let's go ahead and take our second and final break, and we'll circle back here momentarily with the rest of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
People always coming up to me and asking, what's your secret? With all you do, your attitude just seems to be so good. How do you keep it? Well, I'm not the Dalai Lama, but I'll try to offer up a few words of advice. You better get to living, giving. Don't forget to throw in a little forgiving and love along the way. You better get to knowing, showing a little bit more concern about where you're going. There's a word unto the wise. You better get to living.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-782-1900. That's 713-782-1900. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com. That's Nathan at npross.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Like the song, Bobby McGee, I'm just longing. Take me where I want to be. Big dreams and fake dreams. And there are many just like me
with big dreams and fake dreams.
Okay, welcome back to the final segment of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And, you know, it kind of slipped past me last week. I should have discussed what I'm getting ready to a week ago or more. But, you know, a lot of things on my mind every week. And the show is just one of several things I'm always juggling. For those of you that have IRAs that are invested in these real estate private partnership syndications, the 30 1st of May is a deadline for you. I was trying to figure out when the 31st falls. Let's see. Today's, what, the 23rd? So it's a little over a week away. But, you know, I guess Quest Trust is the, or was, the thing it's called Inspira now, Inspira Financial. So some of our listeners no doubt have IRAs there that are invested in some of the syndicated investments that are on some of the local platforms. And I don't think I've ever heard a good explanation, and I have to admit I've shied away from explaining it unless it's to a existing client. But I think I can talk about this without, you know, somebody circling back later and say, you know, you told us it was wrong, or you, what you told us was wrong, and I shouldn't have done anything near what I thought I understood you to say. And I'm just going to tell you right up front here, what I'm getting ready to tell you is not a DIY scenario. Don't do it unless you're in the business of performing fair market valuations on syndicated passive real estate investments like we are, okay? But every May 31st, the custodians have a deadline to file a value for your IRA if you've got a self-directed IRA. And that sounds like, oh, well, that's not a big deal, until you realize, well, wait a minute, I can't get, there's no exchange that I can go look at to get the value of any one of the syndications I'm in. Doesn't exist. And, you know, I know for years I simply told lead partners, because that's a discussion, I'm going to double down on what I said at the beginning of the show, which is I've yet to meet the lead partner that truly understands how some of the operational aspects of these partnerships and partners, and of course the IRA is a partner if it's invested in one of these syndicated arrangements. And I don't want to confuse you. I'm not suggesting we're looking for the number that I've seen many lead partners proudly pass out every year that shows the broker's opinion of value. Not asking for the property value. We're trying to come up with the value of our partnership. Excuse me. Partnership investment. Big difference. The value of the property may be what the broker opinion of value reflects. May not be. I mean, again, there's nobody that the brokers don't understand what we understand when it comes to valuing partnerships, particularly in private company investments. And you've heard me talk about this topic in the context of Roth conversions. And now I'm talking about it simply in terms of you being able to respond. I'm sure those of you that have syndications in your IRAs are aware that every year you get a letter from the custodian. You may not have realized what it was. Most people that I've talked to don't understand what it is, and they usually call the lead partner, and he'll tell them something like I used to tell lead partners, because I wasn't telling them an answer that related to my clients individually. And so I, you know, like, hey, if you want to finesse it, then you need to sign up with an accountant or somebody in the retirement plan space that understands the type of discounts we get for valuing private company investments. And you may be thinking, well, what does this have to do with the price of eggs, right? Like, why is this important? And the reason is because some of you may be working down the required minimum distributions that either you have or maybe one of your parents or someone that's passed, and you ended up with being bequeathed the IRA. And you may or may not understand that generally you've got a 10-year period wherein you need to be taking RMDs over the 10 years of whatever amount that IRA is worth. And when you're dealing with these real estate private partnerships, first of all, we get significant discounts, such as lack of marketability, lack of majority control. It's the things we've talked about before in the context of the Roth conversion, same issues. And when you ask, well, what difference does it make? Well, let's assume you had all of your IRA funds invested in real estate private partnerships. And let's further assume that even in a good year, you've got at least 40 to 50% discounts to maybe the amount that you originally invested that might apply. And in some cases, like over the last year or two, there's been enough distress in the market where you're probably sitting on some partnerships that aren't worth even 5 to 10% of what you put into them. And they're just basically comatose. And so what happens is you can follow the math if you understand how the minimum distribution is calculated. You've got a numerator, which is the value, total value of the IRA, and you're dividing it by a denominator, which is your life expectancy factor off the IRS tables. So you can understand it can significantly reduce the amount of your taxable required minimum distribution if you're properly assessing those values on those partnerships. And you know, that's one example. You know, there's other reasons. Roth conversions are still one of them, although we can't convert an inherited IRA. But generally speaking, we're not just talking about inherited IRAs when we talk about the form 5498 is the form that the custodian will need to file by the 31st. And I'm sure many of you have gotten those forms in every year, and you probably wonder, why does that come in so late? In fact, most investors understand they shouldn't file until later in the year. There's a number of reasons. And if you don't want to believe me, that's fine. If you'll email me, I'll send you a email that I trapped a number of years ago from one of the celebrity CPAs out there, written a ton of books, I can't believe I can't remember her name right at the moment, but I'll share that with you. And it, only because, you know, she's an author, she's out there. Don't believe Nathan Ross, Diane Kennedy is her name, just came to me. When you reach my age, your brain's kind of like when you bump, or your memory's kind of like bumping your desk and your hard drive skips. It'll come back around. Just give it a few seconds, right? But in any event, Diane Kennedy espouses some of the reasons. I can name several others that affect. In fact, it's kind of interesting. She doesn't mention the reasons in the retirement plan space, IRAs, et cetera, as to why you should never file a tax return on the initial deadline. Always extend, file it later in the year. And I just, every time I hear a self-made millionaire or self-made guru discuss this topic, and they act like you should never, ever extend your return. And all I can say is it's like Red Adair, famous Houston-based oil well firefighter, used to say, he said, you think the professionals are expensive, just try the amateurs. And I think of that every time I hear bad tax advice, like always file your returns on the initial due date. Like, you should always rip the Band-Aid off your IRAs and 401s and pay the man, pay the tax to the man, be done with the man, as if that does anything at all towards being done with the man. You know what you are done with at that point? You're done with about 40 to 50% of your family's net worth. And I would suggest you ask the next guru that tells you that, where do you go to get your net worth back? Because it's gone. And you don't get any return on those dollars once you cut the check. And you don't have to do it. You can still control your money with the appropriate rollover to the appropriate self-directed style plan. You can take distributions whenever you wish to. You're not just paying the 401, as I've heard one of our self-made millionaire gurus say many, many times. I know he's smarter than that. He knows that what I'm telling you is correct, but that doesn't sell memberships. So just remember that, and just remember the rule that I'm telling you is never, ever, ever roll or rip the Band-Aid off of your retirement funds if the reason you think you're doing it is so you can control your money, invest in real estate, and refocus or do whatever makes you happy. And we can do that with not paying the IRS 30 to 40% of your family's net worth. So, in any event, let's see. I had a couple questions come in this past week. One of them, a couple of them are dealing with Roth conversions, and I've had this question before. I know we've discussed it on the air, but it is a good question to review. And I know that this sounds odd, maybe even bizarre, that we can do this, but we don't have to sell the underlying partnership investment to do the Roth conversion. In other words, we can value it where it sits right now. You know, you've invested $100,000 a year ago, and now we're sitting at the end of the year in our illustration, not literally, but we would be close to the end of the year and looking at whether you should convert. And of course, we don't like to go up over the 22 to 24% tax bracket if we can avoid doing so. Depending on what you think the rates are going to be, you may say, hey, if we need to go to the 32% bracket, I'm ready to do that. And of course, if you're a high income earner and you're already close to that, well, then you don't have much choice. But your choice is not, I mean, the choice isn't really between 32 and 24. It's really between 32 now and maybe 50 later, which is probably what's going to happen. And I saw a video yesterday, I believe it was, on a YouTube short. Some financial planner was trying to make the argument that it's the same outcome if you convert now versus, you know, 20 years in the future, 10 years in the future. I can't remember exactly how many years. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Let's watch the math here as he draws this out. And sure enough, it didn't take me long to realize, oh, he's assuming you're in a 30% tax bracket today, and in 20 years, you're going to be in the same 30% tax bracket. Well, guess what? He's probably the only one in the financial arena in the world that thinks that tax rates are going to be the same 20 years down the road. Has he not looked at the extreme deficit that we have? Where does he think that deficit is going to go? How's it going to go away, right? And I'll just tell you, I know since I started practicing back in 19, this hurts me to even think about this. 1983, I've heard the tax rates are going up. The tax rates are going up. And then you turn around, what, 40 years later, we're sitting here, and the rates have literally never been lower in our lifetime, I mean, for the most part. And so, you know, here we are again, Nathan, and you're saying the rates are going up. Well, never before in our lifetime or in our recent past has our percentage of debt to GDP been up in the 130%+ range, right? And never in our past have we had a cumulative debt of 37, 38 trillion. I don't have my debt clock up here on the screen, but it's somewhere in that neighborhood. $37 trillion. And at some point, we're not going to be able to keep printing dollars and selling T-bills. The rest of the world is going to say no. In fact, we just got downgraded again, I believe, this past week. I didn't read the entirety of the article. It's amazing we haven't been downgraded several times. I think this may have just been the second time. But each downgrade cost us big time in terms of the amount of money that we end up paying out for interest expense. And, you know, for those of you that aren't aware, if you've been sleeping under a rock, our annual interest expense now on the U.S.'s public debt is over $1.1 trillion now. It's the third largest budget category behind Medicaid/Medicare and Social Security, ahead of defense spending. Isn't that remarkable? We are spending more on the interest to service our cumulative debt. And we're not talking about the unfunded mandates we've already voted on. We're simply talking about the debt that affects the current year's budget cycle. And it's just crazy how much money we're spending on interest. Think if we had an extra $1 trillion to do whatever. Man, you know, the military, you know, is now embarking on the Golden Dome, I believe I heard Trump describe, and there's other things that we could do. Take care of the homeless, the cancer research. I mean, $1 trillion extra a year would be welcome. Okay, well, we're at the end of the show. I appreciate you joining in once again, and we will be back on Sunday with another version of the Be A Planner Cybersecurity Show. I know Mr. A.I. Nguyen has assorted topics that I look forward to hearing, and we hope you can join us right here on AM 700 KSEV. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.